The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. With little Rad commanding my life lately and lots of audiobooks needing some overdue attention, I wanted to still try to get an episode out for you guys, even though I've been a little slow on getting my new recordings done this past week or two. But with the markets today taking another vicious dump, with DeFi having a stroke and Celsius joining the graveyard next to Luna for insolvent crypto services, with a crashing token and now frozen withdrawals just a few hours ago. It just feels like this is the perfect time to reboot a classic. And I got recommended this by somebody on Twitter, or maybe it was in my group. I think it was somebody on Twitter. Whoever you were, thank you. I already lost your tweet, so I can't link to it. But somebody suggested Everyone is a Scammer. Everyone's a Scammer by Michael Goldstein. And if there is anything that needs to be listened to in this space again at this time, it is Michael Goldstein's masterpiece. So really quick, before we jump into it, let's thank our sponsors. First, the BitBox hardware wallet. If you had your coins on your BitBox and not on the exchanges or not on Celsius, or in some DeFi collateral or interest-bearing savings account, well, your coins are safely in your possession because they are on your BitBox. They're behind your keys. You have self-custodied, and you have a BitBox hardware wallet. 5% off with code GUY. Don't get caught in these storms. Hold your keys. Second, I want to thank Swan Bitcoin, and especially Corey Clipston, for banging the hell out of the alarm bells for both Luna Terra for weeks before it collapsed, and now Celsius. He is 2 for 2 on calling out the implosions in the shitcoin market and has saved a ton of people a ton of money. Kudos to Corey, CEO of Swan Bitcoin, by the way. This is why I use Swan Bitcoin. Like I said, they have an awesome crew. They know what they're doing. And if you have an auto stack through this is just a great opportunity. Go to swanbitcoin.com/guy. And lastly, we have the Fold card. This is basically the best time to have some bills come in because you get to spin on the stuff and you get more sats when the price is down. The Fold card gives you sats back on everything in your fiat life and you get 20% off with code BitcoinAudible. Check them out in the show notes. But let's jump into today's read. A reboot of the one, the only, the number one lesson for all Bitcoiners: why you hold your keys, why you keep your head down, why you do not trade, and you do not leverage, and you do not shitcoin. And it's titled Everyone's a Scammer by Michael Goldstein. There's a war going on. Bonnie and Clyde cannot simply rob First National Blockchain. They can hack servers and unencrypted wallet files or scan low-entropy brain wallets. But the costs of obtaining bitcoins hoarded on a high-entropy, password-protected paper wallet, for instance, are incredibly high. A computer cannot be expected to brute-force the wallet in the universe's lifetime, so a trespasser would have to employ expensive tactics such as kidnapping and torture on any prospective individual target. Criminals, con artists, and swindlers cannot rely on violence to get the wealth they desire. It has become too cumbersome. These scoundrels must rely on good old-fashioned market forces. And it's working. Bitcoin is poised for exponential growth, so the opportunity costs of not being involved in the highest personal degree possible are incalculable. Yet merchants, investment peddlers, and other hoarders have been able to convince countless Bitcoiners to part with their future riches
despite the obvious downsides, given you have a long enough time horizon to see the coming post-fiat world. They'll tell you spending is vital, that Bitcoin 2.0 will be even better if only you give them some of your Bitcoin 0.9, or that your Bitcoins are worth only $475 apiece. They'll tell you this with a straight face, the wringing of their hands unseen across the internet. And once you have fallen to temptation, they'll leave you on your own to learn that there are no backseats. In the real politic of the blockchain, everyone is a scammer. There is a war going on for your Bitcoins, and willpower is your only defense. Endless scammers everywhere. Bitcoin is a dangerous place. There is an endless list of hacks, scams, and thefts. Bitcoin promises a network with distributed trust. You know why? Because other Bitcoiners exist. Not every Bitcoin scammer is merely an amoral businessman or investor. Many are outright fraudsters and con artists. When you buy a rug from Overstock, at least you actually get a rug. When you send money to Ethereum, you may actually get a worthless Ether token, eventually. You know what you probably will never get? Your Butterfly Labs pre-order or your Gox Bucks. Some scams are pulled off by convincing other Bitcoiners to not take advantage of Bitcoin's value proposition. That is, they convince Bitcoiners that while they shouldn't trust third parties, this guy is totally cool. I'm looking at you, Mt. Gox. Others convince them to play investment games that turn out to be Ponzi schemes. Sup, Bitcoin Savings and Trust. Some scams are the purest synthesis of Bitcoiner avarice and stupidity. Ponzi.io explicitly marketed itself as a Ponzi scheme, promising to send you back more Bitcoins coming from the pockets of the next investors. Have fun. Their address? 1 Ponzi UJUC etc. received nearly 350 Bitcoin. Some scams are outright malicious. Scammers have resorted to malware and ransom. CryptoLocker infected computers by encrypting the user's files and only gave up the private key if a ransom was paid in bitcoins within 48 hours. Scammers have resorted to blackmail. On September 8th, a hacker gained control of Satoshi Nakamoto's email account, using it not only to deface the Bitcoin SourceForge page, but to allegedly find out Satoshi's true name. From a Vice article, quote, "After inquiring what the hacker was trying to get out of all this, he said, Bitcoins, obviously, but don't forget the lulz," end quote. Scammers have also gone to the trouble of leaking nude photos of celebrities to get some Bitcoins. Scammers will do whatever it takes to increase their Bitcoin holdings. You know this. You scammed someone to get yours. You probably did not outright defraud or hack someone like the above, but you necessarily took advantage of their short-term thinking. Merchants are scammers. At long last, Newegg accepts Bitcoin, along with Overstock.com, Tiger Direct, Dell.com, Expedia, and other major retailers and websites. So let's go spend all our Bitcoins, right? Not so fast. Let's wipe off the drool from looking at all the shiny toys and think this through. Merchants have absolutely every reason to accept Bitcoin. BitPay recently removed all fees for payment processing, including currency exchange. Not only can merchants receive payments without fees, but there are, of course, a litany of other benefits, from no fraud or chargebacks to easy international payments. They can pass on their savings to customers or increase their profit margins. They also can and should hold on to Bitcoins as their accounting permits, so as to earn profits from future price increases. After all, if Bitcoin increases adoption for payments, there are only so many units to go around, so each one will become more valuable. So merchants are in a good position. They can save money on their business, and they can try to purchase Bitcoins with retail goods, just as many purchase them with dollars or euros. If I were a merchant, I would most certainly encourage people to shop at my store in Bitcoin. I might even try to convince them, despite its fallacious economic reasoning, that spending Bitcoins at my store is actually good for Bitcoin. certainly more than you saving and speculating on them. After all, quote, it could become worthless overnight, and its future depends on it, because I say so. I might even say things like, quote, my shoppers are among the first wave of Bitcoin users, and we're thrilled to accept the cryptocurrency as a form of payment. Just like you, we also believe Bitcoin can be the future of digital currency. But if you've been saving it and hoping it will make you rich one day, you're better off spending it if you want it to succeed. End quote. By me, I mean Newegg. Their recent blog post is called, Why Saving Your Bitcoin is Not a Good Idea. The reason? It means you aren't spending it at Newegg. Most merchants even choose to immediately sell the Bitcoins they receive. They scam you out of Bitcoins that they do not even want, uninterested in the future value of the network. Merchants are scammers because they lead you to believe that your Bitcoins are only worth the price of their retail good in order to allow themselves, or those to whom they sell the Bitcoins if they so choose, rather than you, to benefit from future Bitcoin price increases. And that's a good thing. This is not to say merchant adoption is bad. In fact, from the hoarder's perspective, merchant adoption is great. First, merchant adoption means that there is more demand for Bitcoin, that the Bitcoin network is growing, and that Bitcoin is thus more valuable than it was yesterday. Second, merchant adoption means that there are more places to spend Bitcoins. This does not mean a hoarder will actually want to spend Bitcoins. More importantly, he can spend Bitcoins. Demand for cash exists because there is uncertainty of future needs, and the holder of cash believes he will come across currently unknown opportunities in the future that can better satisfy his needs than any current opportunities. When an opportunity exists that he believes benefits him more than what the same cash can get him in the future, he is able to seize it. As Metcalfe's law shows us, the value of a network increases exponentially with each additional node. With each additional merchant, there are more potential people to trade with and thus more potential opportunities to satisfy his needs with cash. Of course, these benefits to the hoarder does not require merchants accepting Bitcoin given the right infrastructure. Zappo debit cards, for instance, give the hoarder the ability to use Bitcoins on existing credit card networks. This means hoarders can already use Bitcoin as their unit of account, whether or not merchants even know what a Bitcoin is. The more Bitcoin can be used as a method of payment, the fewer dollars hoarders must begrudgingly speculate on, a risk they typically only wish on government agents and skeptical economists. Thus, the primary advantage of merchant adoption is that your average balance of Bitcoins held can go up. You don't need to buy dollars in anticipation of making dollar payments. Instead, you can replenish your Bitcoin hoard after you make Bitcoin payments. Between merchant adoption and debit systems, Bitcoin becomes a more valuable good to hoard. Good news for Bitcoin. Investments are scams. Bitcoin is exciting. Looking at a static wallet file and balance is not. Instead of holding and forgetting, many Bitcoiners choose to put that money to use, and endless crypto peddlers are ready to snatch your Bitcoins up. They'll offer you mining contracts, present their plans for a hedge fund, or entice you into investing in a Bitcoin company. Today, the most popular investment vehicle for Bitcoiners are Bitcoin 2.0 schemes, ranging from MasterCoin to Ethereum. All of these are scams. Regardless of their ability to actually deliver their promises, they all fail a simple test. Is the return on investment positive? If you are stuck in a fiat mindset, you may well make a quick buck. But given Bitcoin's extraordinary expected growth, can one really expect to do better than one can by holding it? Long-term investors should use Bitcoin as their unit of account, and every single investment should be compared to the expected returns of Bitcoin. If hyper-Bitcoinization occurs, Bitcoin holders will see their purchasing power increase by orders of magnitude. Bitcoiners should think twice before throwing away even a couple of millibits toward a project just to see where it goes. A running joke in the community is how expensive the two pizzas Laszlo bought were. We joke about a $1 million pizza, and hyper-Bitcoinization has not even occurred yet. I praise Laszlo for his entrepreneurial use of a new technology, but I do not wish for myself or others to be a Laszlo. Who wins here? It is not the investor, but the peddler of crypto dreams. Ethereum recently raised $15 million in their Ether sale for an unfinished project. In Bitcoin, of course. There isn't even a product yet, but investors have placed their bets. Ethereum now has over 30,000 Bitcoins, destined to be worth unspeakable volumes of wealth, while investors hold worthless hope. Investments are scams because they lead you to believe you can get a higher return than holding Bitcoin itself, despite the economics of Bitcoin naturally making this an absurd claim in the medium run. In a post-fiat world, there will be plenty of investments that have a greater return and risk than holding Bitcoins, but they'll be assets that generate Bitcoin cash flows. But they don't have to be. If a Bitcoin hoarder wants to reinvest his profits, he need not go further than the Bitcoin network itself. The correct strategy for Bitcoin entrepreneurship, as Daniel has pointed out, is speculative philanthropy. While endless money has been funneled into altcoins, appcoins, vaporware, vulnerable third-party services, etc., there are many problems in Bitcoin that still need to be solved through open-source development, many of which are low-hanging fruit. By funding these projects, the security, accessibility, and usability of the Bitcoin network increase, thus making it an even better investment. Git coding. Every new Git commit is good news for Bitcoin. Hoarders are scammers. The Bitcoin hoarder is in a constant battle with himself to lower his time preference as much as humanly possible. It's the only way to optimize his Bitcoin holdings. My friends and I joke about starving due to the intense deflation, but I can't say I don't look back and wish I had skipped a couple of lunches in the crappy dorm cafeteria to buy $10 more of Bitcoins when I had the chance. Bitcoin hoarders are excited about the price rises, but they are also excited when the price is on its way down. Coinbase just months ago was willing to give me a Bitcoin for $1,200, and now they are only asking for $475. Whatever price, the Bitcoin hoarder thinks to himself, suckers. Bitcoin hoarders are in it for the long run. Their strategy is not to buy low, sell high, but to buy any, sell some highest. They will do anything to get their hands on more Satoshis, and there is nothing that makes them happier than a schmuck giving up the goods after being convinced Bitcoin is only worth X amount of dollars, less than moon. These sellers have volunteered to hold the fiat shitbag, and hoarders will not be so quick to help them get rid of the stench. Indeed, hoarders are potentially the most dangerous scammers. While merchants and investments are outright with their desire to take your bitcoins, hoarders may not always be so explicit. A person can prove that they have the private key to bitcoins, but they cannot prove that they do not. With this in mind, it is plausible that any vociferous skeptic's bold assertion is actually a psyop attempting to affect market demand, and subsequently the price, in their favor. For instance, when Paul Krugman recently said in the long CryptoCon that it's not at all clear whether Bitcoin has any economic value, we cannot know with epistemological certainty that Paul Krugman is not a Bitcoin true believer hoping to get his hands on more and cheaper Bitcoins. Hoarders are scammers because they understand the exponential and very likely growth potential of Bitcoin, yet are willing to convince other Bitcoin holders by any means necessary that the future value of them is probably not much more than the current market price. And you should thank them. Hoarding is what gives money value. And no, you can't have any. The Hoarding Feedback Loop. people hoard Bitcoin. This causes a higher Bitcoin price, which leads to higher mining profitability and greater media attention. The higher profitability leads to greater total hashing power, which leads to greater security of the network. The greater security plus the added media attention leads to a greater perceived legitimacy. This leads to greater business adoption and greater user adoption, which leads us back to more hoarding and a higher Bitcoin price, etc., etc. Great news for Bitcoin. How to end it all. Indeed, Bitcoin scamming is a job that will never be finished. The market-based scams, that is, the ones that don't require fraud, will subside as Bitcoin absorbs the real money supply of all other currencies, when demand for cash begins to decelerate and eventually stabilizes. However, other scammers will always be looking for ways to screw someone out of their Bitcoins. The only way this will be solved is if trusted networks can be built. As has been said before, Bitcoin is great, but it won't fix our monkey brains. While Bitcoin offers a money with no trusted third party, it can only do so because the ledger is self-referential. The humans actually using it must always be in a mindset of caveat emptor when using Bitcoin. Through payment protocols, webs of trust, smart contracts, GPG contracts, and voting pools, users can mitigate the risk of engaging in various forms of commerce. The only winning move is not to spend. We live in a state of total war. Everyone who holds bitcoins is trying to get more by scamming others out of theirs or convincing others it's not worth trying to get into. Everyone who does not hold bitcoins was either scammed out of them or was scammed from getting into it. Having bitcoins takes the knowledge and the will to know and desire its future, while not having or spending them is lacking one or the other. If you hold bitcoins, you must take a breath every time you wish to send any to another person. Ask yourself if that person truly deserves untold amounts of your future wealth for pouring you a beer. You may just find the will to hold more. Hyper-Bitcoinization will not be a force to trifle with. Even a marginal Bitcoin holding right now will constitute a very significant majority of a Bitcoiner's portfolio. Once it happens, there is no going back. One day, your Bitcoin balance will likely never see the decimal point move to the right again. Bitcoin will break for no one on its race down the road from serfdom to global domination or liberation. Do not give up your seat for someone else. Before we get into a fresh guy's take in the craziness that is today, are you worried about insolvent exchanges? Well, that's why you get your Bitcoin on your BitBox. Are you worried about DeFi blowing up and wiping out your collateral? Well, that's why you get your Bitcoin on your BitBox. Are you worried about malware on your computer or hackers getting in and stealing your keys? Well, that's why you get your Bitcoin on your BitBox. Are you worried that securing your keys is going to be too complicated or the software is going to be too complex to use? Well, obviously, that's why you got a BitBox. So, the market's pretty crappy right now. Having counterparty risk in this environment can really make or break a lot of people. This is why you follow the foundational rules that Bitcoiners have created over the years. And these were born of the many times in the past that the markets, that the services, that everything felt just like this. And at the top of that list is hold your own keys. That is exactly what the BitBox O2 is going to provide for you. The software is clean and intuitive. The setup process is quick and easy. The device is secure. And you just know your coins belong to you. Save 5% with code GUY by going to guyswan.com/bitbox. You know, the best time to hold your keys was yesterday, but the second best time is now. Again, that's guyswan.com/bitbox. All right, let's jump back in.
Always a classic. Goldstein really killed it with that one. And also, actually, just because I haven't read anything off of this, and for anybody who doesn't know, you can get this as well as so many of the other, like, really good works, particularly some of the older works in this space, at the Nakamoto Institute, nakamotoinstitute.org. This is a great, great resource for some of the cypherpunk history and the both kind of the philosophy, the engineering, the adversarial thinking, everything that went into this. I mean, you can learn about hash cash, digital time stamping, and all of the iterations through the 90s as, you know, as these ideas like how to make reliable digital time stamping. This is where you can find all of Nick Szabo's like really key works, trusted third parties or security holes, shelling out, all of this stuff. So if you want to dig into really the history, where Bitcoin came from and why Bitcoin is the way it is, there is so much in the 2012 to 2014 era where a lot of this was kind of a foundation for kind of the culture and the thinking in the space. And of course, obviously the decades leading up to actually creating Bitcoin and the cypherpunk culture that Bitcoin arose from. I really think if you want to look for how Bitcoin became Bitcoin, how a lot of the culture and the antagonism to, you know, the shitcoin space and the degeneracy, where all that started, I think that's a really good place to start to get a clean, all signal, no noise exploration of a lot of the ideas and reasons for Bitcoin's existence. And what better time to get a little perspective than when the entire crypto and DeFi system seems to be imploding. So it's really interesting. We're a little bit in uncharted waters. You know, every time we go through one of these hype cycles, there's the space has changed in some way, in some pretty major way. And one of the things that this, even with the 2017 ICOs and everything, the thing that I believe has changed drastically that is unique to our situation today with this market dump is the staggering amounts of collateralized DeFi used to create or issue another token that's collateralized. Like that entire market that is basically tied together. It's so much like, it reminds me so much of what I see as a problem in the legacy finance system, is that there's no real asset at the back of all of this. Like at the source of the circle, there's, you know, it's circular all the way down. So you never actually have a hard asset. It's like the value of the token is that you can then lock it up to get this other token, et cetera, et cetera. It's like Luna and Terra. I know we talked about this a couple different times on the show, and there's actually another piece that I kind of want to read by Nick Carter and Alan Farrington, which shares a lot from On Impossible Things for Breakfast, or On Impossible Things Before Breakfast. If you haven't listened to that, you really, really need to kind of get a grasp of what the hell happened and why there's still a massive amount of risk in the crypto space in general, and that we would expect this to continue to unravel in some form or fashion. Like, it is unsustainable. Does it all unravel now? I don't know. You know, a lot of this, I think, really has to do with the Fed. The Fed is in a horrible position. The ECB is in a horrible position. Like, where we are in the traditional financial world and how it affects Bitcoin and the crypto ecosystem is, man, I don't know. It's a super, super interesting and super volatile space because Bitcoin is largely being used as a risk asset, whereas DeFi is creating like this digitized version of everything that's wrong with finance. And what I mean, actually, the reference I was just making is that like a major problem with the traditional financial system and essentially fractional reserve at its foundation, at its core, fractional reserve is unsustainable. And it's because you need more debt. You need more liability than you can actually pay for in order to create enough money supply to fulfill the previous subset of liabilities. So if you look at, and I just posted this, this is actually, I just screenshotted it or saved it from Lynn Alden's latest piece about the ECB situation, which is also really good. It'll be available in audio hopefully sooner rather than later. But like I said, my schedule's a little all over the place right now. It's just tracking the liabilities, like total debts, versus like M2 and GDP, and actually like circulating cash, like how much actual money is there versus how much money is tied up or not collateralized. It's how much money is spoken for versus how much money is actually there. What are the liabilities versus actual capital that is available? And what we have done in the fractional reserve economy, what we have done in a interest rate manipulated economy, is we have created cascading fragility. This kind of goes back to what Marty Bent was talking about in the Bent cascading risk. I don't remember what it was, but it's not too long ago. I'll find the link to it, so it's in the show notes. He was talking about essentially how everything is tied together, these liabilities and the counterparty risk in the legacy finance system, in the economy, are so tied together. And this is because of a handful of different reasons, but really, truly, it's foundational to fractional reserve. Because what you end up doing is creating new capital as debt. Everything is a liability. And real savings and real assets are the buffer to making sure that the liabilities do not domino through the economy. So if you issue new money as liabilities, and your liability is always the new debt, the new money issued into existence, plus its interest rate, plus what is owed for the time that you are using that capital, which means that inevitably it's always going to be more than the money created. But if you owe a $100,000 loan with 10% interest, well, then you owe $100,000 plus 10%, right? And that's just with the first year if you're paying that higher percentage. But you only created $100,000 into existence. And if you need the economy to grow, and as the Keynesian theory goes, you must issue new money to make the economy, to help the economy grow, or the economy can't grow, well, then what you have is a situation where you have to create another $100,000 into existence with another 10% obligation just to have the excess money necessary to pay off the original $100,000. So in their messed up little economics, it's kind of true, is that you're going to have a credit crisis at some point unless you are always creating more debt to pay for the previous obligations. But what happens? You have this cascading fragility. You have this constant counterparty risk to counterparty risk, where when one person defaults or one person becomes insolvent, that completely screws up the appearance of the value of the assets of the next person, because they are only propped up by the appearance of being backed by this company, or being, because there was a corporate loan in which they bought back their stock price, and then that stock was then used as collateral in somebody's loan, or it's used to value someone's retirement, which is what they're leveraging in order to actually quit their job, and that's how they're making their financial plans, and that's why they took out a loan at 1% or 3% to buy a house, because they were sure they could afford it and they were about to retire, et cetera, et cetera. Like, you just go down this line of everyone making plans based on value that they think they have and assets that they think they own, but that are all dependent on the counterparty risk of someone else's liability. And when those liabilities start to blow up, the value loss cascades through everybody's portfolio. And then you get this massive joint meltdown because nobody had buffers. Nobody had real value. Nobody had real savings between any of this. And that's what we're seeing in crypto at the same time. And crypto is like that on steroids. It's like, how can we digitize and automate this without having to worry about the actual producing of things? How do we just do it with tokens on top of governance and inflation? It's like everything wrong with central banking and everything wrong with traditional finance, with all of the actual equity just ripped out from underneath it. It's just, let's programmatically recreate a massive speculative stock market with no stock. And thus, here we are. Here we are with the unraveling of this craziness with Federal Reserve and central banks that cannot lower interest rates because you're going to get massive inflation, and we're experiencing massive inflation, and they have to do something to keep it in check. But that if they don't lower interest rates, if they don't allow the creation of new money, well, then the economy can't grow. Well, it's the appearance of growth. It's not actually growth. It's unsustainable. It's just exacerbating the problem. But in their minds, it's either let the economy absolutely crash and be wiped out because we have to clear out like $10 trillion in garbage debt. And, well, that's not even true. You're probably looking at like $100 trillion of future liabilities. The amount of just crap that we have to fix in the financial system is rather incredible. So that's one option, is to just let it default. Let the whole thing go up in flames. But also remember that when they raise interest rates, or when they let interest rates rise in the market, this increased the borrowing costs of the government. So the government can't pay for welfare, can't pay for Medicare. They can't pay for any of this stuff at 4%, 5%, 7% interest. Are you kidding? They can't afford any of that crap. So their bonds, that's when you have like the bond market start to fall apart. And you, when you start going back around, this is why I feel like it's such a coin flip, right? Is that what's the Federal Reserve going to do? What's the government going to try to push to happen? Are they going to save the dollar? Or are they going to save the U.S. government and the spending apparatus that they have created, this huge appeal to all the ESG companies, all the like this corporate environment and this corporate welfare society, this crony capitalism society is only sustainable because of the ability to print money and the ability to issue massive amounts of new debt for the government to spend at will. They don't have to tax people blind. They don't have to do a 60% blanket tax to afford all this shit. What they do is they just go into more debt, but they can quote unquote afford the debt because they manipulate their own interest rates. They get to set the interest rate on their credit card because they print the credit tokens. So what happens when the credit tokens themselves start to lose value, and either A, the government can't pay for shit because the credit tokens they're creating, them that they've cheated themselves into for God knows how long, are finally not being accepted by the market. They're being valued at their true value, and thus you can't purchase things without just constantly inflating the supply. And you think 8% inflation is bad? We're going to be seeing 10%, 15%, 20%. Like you're going to see the price of the currency, the value of the currency, pay for all of the liabilities that we can't afford. Or they cut everything. Or they tax everybody 70% across the board and try to pay for their government programs, and people actually understand what the fuck it costs to run this giant leviathan of nonsense, of government control, of corporate subsidies, of welfare, of constant war. Suddenly we have to actually understand, we have to feel what that cost is, not to mention to do that in the middle of a depression, which we are clearly in. The fact that they haven't even called this a recession, they don't have the balls to call this a recession yet, is almost comical. Like, I'm still seeing blue check saying, well, luckily the economy's better than it's ever been. Look at the job numbers. Like, Jesus, you're so freaking stupid. It's unbelievable. If there was ever a description of a non-playable character, there it is. The news said something, the president said something, therefore, that is my tweet. That is the only thing that I know, that's the only thing I understand about the whole freaking world. And do 10% inflation, 15% inflation across the board, 30% inflation in housing, doesn't matter. Economy's great. Everybody's miserable. Political divides are worse than they've ever been. Stock markets look like an absolute bloodbath. But nah, guys, it's the best economy ever. But that's what they have to do to sustain the machine they have created, to sustain all of these industries and this apparatus that is built up around government spending and government subsidy and access to new loans and the financing of things because they're big, and therefore the big thing will always pay off. Like, this entire culture and way that our financial and legacy systems are set up only survive because we've been able to hide the cost of capital. And we are at a point where that can no longer happen, where either A, the currency pays for all of the lies for the last 4 or 5 decades, or the economy does, or the debt markets pay for all of the lies and irresponsibilities and insolvencies of the last 40 to 50 years. And it depends on whether the Fed tightens or loosens into this situation. And the only thing I know about Bitcoin here in regards to what will happen is that I will still be holding my keys, is that Bitcoin will still be money. Bitcoin will be crazy volatile, just like gold was psychotically volatile during the Weimar Republic. You'd get these periods where it would look like everything was okay and they managed to calm things down for a little bit. And then you get this vicious deflation in the currency back in the other direction and gold would absolutely collapse. And then it turns right back around. Like it's all a constant fight between which direction they want the collapse to go. But at the end of the day, Bitcoin is not part of their financial system. Bitcoin is not someone else's debt. It does not have counterparty risk. It has price risks. You can leverage yourself. You can trade and speculate and get yourself into trouble. You can, you know, loan it out on Celsius to try to get 3%. You can do a 1% loan at 10x. And I'll tell you too, as someone who has an Unchained loan, and this got way steeper than I thought. I am slightly leveraged for the stuff that we're doing on the house, but, and I know I've talked about it a little bit on the show, but I had to make sure that I added collateral to, and I've had plenty to make sure that I am over collateralized. But man, it's certainly got a little bit sweaty, you know? And like, I'm still just watching it to make sure that I have the collateral available, because any sort of leverage, even something that you think you can manage when you think you're being conservative, can get you into trouble. Like, it is ultimately a gamble it's a trade, right? So always be as conservative as you can with those things. Know that those are the points, those are the moments when you are giving up your keys. And I'll tell you, I actually posted in the Audionauts, or no, is it the Raleigh Meetup crew? I don't know. Everybody's talking about Celsius. And I literally considered Celsius for a loan for like a minute, for like a handful of minutes, because they were offering a 1% interest, and that was pretty enticing. I at least considered it for that. But the big red flag that no matter what I did, and it required 10x the capital, by the way, so you're risking massive amounts. And I knew that I would have no way of knowing what the hell was happening to my coins. And obviously that was just kind of like, you know, at the end of the day, I knew I wasn't going to decide it, because I have thankfully learned that lesson, or seen the insolvency and these crashes too many times to know that that would have been a stupid decision. But really the thing that was the kicker, that really just, I'm not going to touch Celsius, was the shitcoin. That is like your number one red flag. Okay, you should just stay away from it. Celsius has a company shitcoin, Celsius Coin. And now there's a lot of different reasons to stay away from the company, and a lot of DeFi and all those sorts of things. But that's the number one thing for me that I know. I just like, you know, if you got robbed in this, it's your fault. Like you should know better. So thank God I only considered it for a brief moment. But I hope everybody who is in a situation where they do, I know inevitably some of you guys have loans out there, and I hope you have the collateral. I hope you're doing what you can to protect yourself, because, you know, we're leveraging the greatest asset in the world, and I think Bitcoin has an incredibly bright future, but it's going to have these chaotic moments in the middle, and you don't want to be left holding someone else's bag because you got a little too greedy, or you went out a little bit further on the edge than you knew was safe. And, you know, Bitcoin has no remorse. There is no, oh no, it went down too much. Let's be nice to make sure everybody can, you know, protect themselves and, you know, give them time to sort things out. Let's calm down and, you know, let's make sure they don't lose their restaurant. No, Bitcoin takes the path of greatest pain every time. And everyone else wants your Bitcoin. They want to sell you a token and convince you that this is the way you're going to make more Bitcoin, that you're going to have a higher return. They're going to do everything they can to entice you. They're going to give you a 1% interest just as long as you put up 10x the collateral, because Celsius just needs those coins in their possession. That is the game. Michael Goldstein told it to us, what, 10 years ago now almost? We know how this game plays out. And, you know, stay safe. Got any extra fiat? Stack like mad. Stay humble. Protect yourself. Hold your damn keys. Get yourself a BitBox. DCA. Get back to the grind. Earn and save whatever you can. Focus on your life. Ignore the price. Quit speculating on shitcoin garbage. And, you know, play around, test the new Bitcoin tools and services whenever you have the extra time. But through all of it, the most important thing you can do is listen to Bitcoin Audible. That is right. Thank you guys so much. And I will catch you on the next episode of Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan. And until then, everybody, take it easy, guys. You have been listening to Bitcoin Audible, a 111 production.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.